The cliff front showed a tide mark of about 6 feet, proving that it was not afloat. We steamed along the front of this tremendous glacier for 40 miles, and then, at 8:30 a.m., we were held up by solid pack ice, which appeared to be held by stranded bergs. The depth, 2 cables off the barrier cliff, was 134 fathoms. No further advance was possible that day, but the noon observation, which gave the position as latitude 76 degrees 27 minutes south, longitude 28 degrees 51 minutes west, showed that we had gained 124 miles to the southwest during the preceding 24 hours. The afternoon was not without incident. The bergs in the neighborhood were very large, several being over 200 feet high, and some of them were firmly aground, showing tide marks. A barrier berg bearing northwest appeared to be about 25 miles long. We pushed the ship against a small banded berg, from which Wordy secured several large lumps of biotite granite. While the Endurance was being held slow ahead against the berg, a loud crack was heard, and the geologist had to scramble aboard at once. The bands on this berg were particularly well defined. They were due to morainic action in the parent glacier. Later in the day, the easterly wind increased to a gale. Fragments of floe drifted past at about 2 knots, and the pack to leeward began to break up fast. A low berg of shallow draft drove down into the grinding pack and, smashing against 2 larger stranded bergs, pushed them off the bank. The 3 went away together, pell-mell. We took shelter under the lee of a large stranded berg. A blizzard from the east-northeast prevented us leaving the shelter of the berg on the following day, Sunday, January 17th. The weather was clear, but the gale drove dense clouds of snow off the land and obscured the coastline most of the time. The land, seen when the air is clear, appears higher than we thought it yesterday. Probably it rises to 3,000 feet above the head of the glacier. Caird Coast, as I have named it, connects Coates Land, discovered by Bruce in 1904, with Luitpold Land, discovered by Filchner in 1912. The northern part is similar in character to Coates Land. It is fronted by an undulating barrier, the van of a mighty ice sheet that is being forced outward from the high interior of the Antarctic continent, and apparently is sweeping over low hills, plains, and shallow seas as the great Arctic ice sheet once pressed over northern Europe. The barrier surface, seen from the sea, is of a faint golden brown color. It terminates usually in cliffs ranging from 10 to 300 feet in height, but in a very few places sweeps down level with the sea. The cliffs are of a dazzling whiteness, with wonderful blue shadows. Far inland, higher slopes can be seen, appearing like dim blue or faint golden fleecy clouds. These distant slopes have increased in nearness and clearness as we have come to the southwest, while the barrier cliffs here are higher and apparently firmer. We are now close to the junction with Luitpold Land. At this southern end of the Caird Coast, the ice sheet, undulating over the hidden and imprisoned land, is bursting down a steep slope in tremendous glaciers, bristling with ridges and spikes of ice and seamed by thousands of crevasses. Along the whole length of the coast we have seen no bare land or rock. Not as much as a solitary nunatak has appeared to relieve the surface of ice and snow. But the upward sweep of the ice slopes towards the horizon and the ridges, terraces, and crevasses that appear as the ice approaches the sea tell of the hills and valleys that lie below. The Endurance lay under the lee of the stranded berg until 7 a.m. on January 18th. The gale had moderated by that time, and we proceeded under sail to the southwest through a lane that had opened along the glacier front. We skirted the glacier till 9:30 a.m., when it ended in 2 bays, open to the northwest, but sheltered by stranded bergs to the west. The coast beyond trended south-southwest, with a gentle land slope. The pack now forces us to go west 14 miles, when we break through a long line of heavy brash mixed with large lumps and growlers. We do this under the fore topsail only, the engines being stopped to protect the propeller. This takes us into open water, where we make south 50 degrees west for 24 miles. Then we again encounter pack, which forces us to the northwest for 10 miles, when we are brought up by heavy snow lumps, brash, and large loose floes. The character of the pack shows change. The floes are very thick and are covered by deep snow. The brash between the floes is so thick and heavy that we cannot push through without a great expenditure of power, and then for a short distance only. We therefore lie to for a while to see if the pack opens at all when this northeast wind ceases. Our position on the morning of the 19th was latitude 76 degrees 34 minutes south, longitude 31 degrees 30 minutes west. The weather was good, but no advance could be made. The ice had closed around the ship during the night, and no water could be seen in any direction from the deck. A few lanes were in sight from the masthead. We sounded in 312 fathoms, finding mud, sand, and pebbles. The land showed faintly to the east. We waited for the conditions to improve, and the scientists took the opportunity to dredge for biological and geological specimens. During the night, a moderate northeasterly gale sprang up, and a survey of the position on the 20th showed that the ship was firmly beset. The ice was packed heavily and firmly all round the Endurance in every direction as far as the eye could reach from the masthead. There was nothing to be done till the conditions changed, and we waited through that day and the succeeding days with increasing anxiety. The east-northeasterly gale that had forced us to take shelter behind the stranded berg on the 16th had veered later to the northeast, and it continued with varying intensity until the 22nd. Apparently this wind had crowded the ice into the bight of the Weddell Sea, and the ship was now drifting southwest with the floes which had enclosed it. A slight movement of the ice round the ship caused the rudder to become dangerously jammed on the 21st, and we had to cut away the ice with ice chisels, heavy pieces of iron with 6-foot wooden hafts. We kept steam up in readiness for a move if the opportunity offered, and the engines running full speed ahead helped to clear the rudder. Land was in sight to the east and south about 16 miles distant on the 22nd. The land ice seemed to be faced with ice cliffs at most points, but here and there slopes ran down to sea level. Large crevassed areas in terraces parallel with the coast showed where the ice was moving down over foothills. The inland ice appeared for the most part to be undulating, smooth, and easy to march over, but many crevasses might have been concealed from us by the surface snow or by the absence of shadows. I thought that the land probably rose to a height of 5,000 feet 40 or 50 miles inland. The accurate estimation of heights and distances in the Antarctic is always difficult, owing to the clear air, the confusing monotony of colouring, and the deceptive effect of mirage and refraction. The land appeared to increase in height to the southward, where we saw a line of land or barrier that must have been 70 miles, but possibly was even more distant. Sunday, January 24th, was a clear, sunny day, with gentle easterly and southerly breezes. No open water could be seen from the masthead, but there was a slight water sky to the west and northwest. This is the first time for 10 days that the wind has varied from northeast and east, and on 5 of these days it has risen to a gale. Evidently the ice has become firmly packed in this quarter, and we must wait patiently till a southerly gale occurs or currents open the ice. We are drifting slowly. The position today was 76 degrees 49 minutes south, 33 degrees 51 minutes west. Worsley and James, working on the floe with a Q magnetometer, found the variation to be 6 degrees west. Just before midnight, a crack developed in the ice, 5 yards wide and a mile long, 50 yards ahead of the ship. The crack had widened to a quarter of a mile by 10 a.m. on the 25th, and for 3 hours we tried to force the ship into this opening, with engines at full speed ahead and all sails set. The sole effect was to wash some ice away astern and clear the rudder, and after convincing myself that the ship was firmly held, I abandoned the attempt. Later in the day, Crean and 2 other men were over the side on a stage, chipping at a large piece of ice that had got under the ship and appeared to be impeding her movement. The ice broke away suddenly, shot upward and overturned, pinning Crean between the stage and the haft of the heavy 11-foot iron pincher. He was in danger for a few moments, but we got him clear, suffering merely from a few bad bruises. The thick iron bar had been bent against him to an angle of 45 degrees. The days that followed were uneventful. Moderate breezes from the east and southwest had no apparent effect upon the ice, and the ship remained firmly held. On the 27th, the 10th day of inactivity, I decided to let the fires out. We had been burning 0.5 ton of coal a day to keep steam in the boilers, and as the bunkers now contained only 67 tons, representing 33 days steaming, we could not afford to continue this expenditure of fuel. Land still showed to the east and south when the horizon was clear. The biologist was securing some interesting specimens with the hand dredge at various depths. A sounding on the 26th gave 360 fathoms, and another on the 29th, 449 fathoms. The drift was to the west, and an observation on the 31st, Sunday, showed that the ship had made 8 miles during the week.